Supernatural Podcast, episode number 38. In this episode, we'll review and discuss Roadkill, Heart, and Hollywood Babylon. So let's start with Roadkill. It originally aired in the U.S. on March 15, 2007. Let's jump into a recap from Wikipedia. Episode was directed by Charles Beeson and written by my favorite writer, Rael Tucker. Hard questions are asked as Sam and Dean hunt for the cause behind accidents that happen on the same night every year on a stretch of Highway 41 in Nevada. On the dark, wintry road, Dean almost hits a woman named Molly as she runs out of the woods flanking the highway. She begs for their help, saying that she and her husband had swerved to miss a farmer, and their car was damaged after smashing into a tree. Her husband is missing, and she is being pursued by the zombie-like farmer. The Impala stalls after a close encounter with the phantom farmer, and the three trek into the woods in search of the ghoul. They find a scrapbook at the farmer's abandoned house showing that his life before it was cut short by a car accident 15 years ago, and had been a good one. He had a loving wife and a happy home. His widow hanged herself due to the grief, and the farmer's inconsolable spirit has been haunting the highway ever since, seeking vengeance on the one who is to blame. When the dead farmer surprises them and kidnaps Molly, the brothers locate and burn his bones, saving her from torture. Sam reveals to Molly the deep faith central to the Winchester's work, the belief that they are sending spirits bound by earthly hatred or love to their rightful place. The fiend vanquished, Molly still refuses to leave the highway without her husband. To appease her, the Winchesters take her to a house where she sees her husband alive and living with another woman. A confused Molly is told that she is the second ghost haunting Highway 41. She died in the crash that had accidentally killed the farmer all those years ago. Although her body was cremated, she lingered behind for her husband and falls prey to the farmer every year. Gradually accepting that she is dead, Molly asks where she is to go from here. Sam admits they don't know her destination, but that it's time for her to leave this existence. So Molly walks peacefully away into a burst of warm morning light, and Dean wonders if she has really moved on to a better place. Sam points out that lasting hope is far more important than knowledge. So let's move on to analysis and theories in my discussion with Josh. Hi, I'm Ellen.
And I'm Josh.
So let's talk about Roadkill. What did you like?
Roadkill, well, I liked the return to the standalone creepiness in the episode. I like that it was a innovative story that was told in the back roads, which is particularly creepy to me, and that it was a episode that was kind of like a first season episode where it was more of a standalone mystery.
Definitely. It had the bad guy, but it did have a lot of the myth and legend, like the urban legend of, you know, the weird person that you see on the highway, and
right,
you're like, okay, are they hitchhiking? Or, you know, there are a lot of legends surrounding weird people on highways. So
right,
sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, sometimes they're not alive, you know.
Right, but they're all pretty creepy.
Yeah. So yeah, I loved the twist on that one. It was a ghost who was haunting herself.
Which, you know, it was a good reference to stories like The Sixth Sense, you know, where the ghost is dead and doesn't know it, and it was neat to see the story told from a different point of view.
Definitely. I wasn't quite sure how that was going to work out, but right, it turned out to be really well done. I think it all came together at the end, and I liked the other guy, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre guy.
Yeah, he was pretty creepy. I think they did a good job with making him, you know, scary and gory, you know.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and they mentioned the afterlife. They, you know, that they didn't know, but, you know, it's part of their job, and we don't see it come up very often.
That's true. And I think that part of what helped the story so well was that they had a guest star who was a pretty good actress, and she was able to sell the part really well.
Yeah, especially at the end. You could tell.
Right.
I mean, even after they'd practiced probably, I don't know, a dozen times, she still made it look believable. This was the first time she heard, oh my God, I'm dead. What?
Right. Exactly. And in the hands of, you know, a lesser actress, it would have been really cheesy.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because the ending was pretty cheesy, but right. I expected to see the little guys come down like they did in Ghost and, you know, whisk her away. But
that's right. Maybe playing some harps, you know.
Yeah, little angels come floating down. But right. But yeah, it was really well done, I think, all the acting.
But like you said, you know, the ending was it felt a little rushed. You know, it's funny that you mentioned Ghost because, you know, he has a whole 2 hours there to figure out that he's dead and how to deal with it and everything. And this poor girl has to figure it all out in 45 minutes and then decide to go into the light.
Yeah, that was pretty quick. It was, right. It was like suddenly I'm dead. Oh, there's my boyfriend. Oh, well, that's a bummer. I guess I'll move on.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah, she gets about 10 minutes to decide, oh, I guess I'm done here. And
yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen, but I'll move on.
The guys had so little emotion. I mean, the end was fine because it wasn't an emotional thing for them. They were just kind of curious as to what was going to happen. But the whole time seemed as if it was all about the secondary characters. And they were just
right.
kind of along for the ride.
Exactly. And, you know, and it sounds maybe contradictory because I said that, you know, I enjoyed that it was told from a different point of view. But you're right. It was like, since it wasn't from their point of view, they seemed really detached and out of it. And, you know, to me, it made the whole story a little bit more boring than it could have been.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. But I like that, I mean, it was that there was that twist that she was the ghost. Because when they first see her on the highway, you just expect, oh, it's some girl whose car broke down or whatever. And you know, they almost hit her. But
right.
in reality, they wouldn't probably have been, I don't know, quite, they wouldn't have acted the same had they not known she was a ghost. And for
That's
whatever
true.
Reason, they knew it was her. I mean, they were on this road that they've probably never been on before. And yes, they were looking for her, I believe, if I remember the story right. But it could have been anybody on the road.
Right.
But suddenly, they just knew who it was. It wouldn't have worked if
yeah.
they wouldn't. But it also didn't seem realistic when I went back and thought about the whole setup again. It was like, they just knew who she was.
That's a good point, because they mention how every year some girl pays for what happened to her or for killing that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of imply that it was a different girl every year.
Exactly.
So how would they know that this wasn't just some girl who was being tortured?
Exactly. That's what seemed, they would have had a little bit more emotion or, I mean, we didn't get to see any of that backstory that we normally do when they're,
right.
when they're, unless they're picking up and then later on they mention about it. Which they've done a couple times where they started the story kind of in the middle. But
right.
this one, they started at the beginning, but we didn't get any story behind it.
Right. No, none of the research that went into it or anything.
Yeah. Not even I heard about this story. And,
right.
you know, nothing. They just knew immediately who it was, but it worked. I mean, you didn't really notice it until the end when you were looking back.
Definitely weird. They get pointers for trying something new and different, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah. I mean, I like the perspective thing, though, because that really did make it seem different than the rest of the episodes. The other weird thing that I thought was the way that it ended. Not just the tying up things, but the actual afterlife part of it. Like I said, with the emotions, you would have thought they were thinking about their mom and dad, and they just were absolutely detached.
Right. Like, would you go ahead and go into the light so we can move on, please? And
yeah.
Not really worrying about... Yeah, because they have to be wondering, you know, they saw their mother do something similarly, you know, when she was haunting their house. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, they don't have any idea what happened to John, so...
Exactly. That seemed just... I don't know. Maybe it was just the writing, or maybe they had so many shots they didn't really care, or I don't know.
Right.
Anything is possible, but it just seemed a little off on that. But
yes.
But the secondary, the girl, she was so good that it didn't really seem all that, I don't know, all that different or...
Right.
I
it was,
know.
You know, about her struggle and her coming to acceptance, which, you know, happened rather quickly, but I guess they were trying to keep the focus on her whole journey instead of worrying about what's going on with Sam and Dean.
I've seen horror movies with less plot than that episode.
And you never know what's left on the cutting room floor.
That is true. Speaking of movies, I saw Cry Wolf a couple
oh, really?
Weekends ago. It was on cable, and I had taped on my DVR, and I watched it. And, oh, I had to. I'm like, well, it's a Jared Padalecki movie, right? Not only did I fall asleep during and have to rewind it and watch part of it again.
Oh, no.
The acting was, like, straight out of Hollywood Babylon.
Oh, no.
It was terrible, and we'll talk about that later, but it was it was terrible.
How sad.
And I wonder if it was made, you know, supposed to have some funny moments, but since I was watching it by myself, I didn't have any other reactions to go off of. Yeah, Jared he was pretty overacted on his part, but honestly, there wasn't much of a script, and the other characters were even worse. So for all of you who haven't seen Cry Wolf, it's... not very scary, not much of a plot, but it's kind of a fun movie. It has a nice twist.
Oh, well, that's good at least.
That I probably would have guessed had I not fallen asleep at about the same time that the twist came up, and so I kind of missed part of it, but yeah, what can I say? There's my review of Cry Wolf.
for free.
Yeah, there you go. But it kind of reminds me of this episode a little bit. So that's why I thought I'd bring it up.
That's interesting.
Yeah, with the twist and the way the characters worked out and what all it was. It's a basic plot device that a lot of movies use, but it was fairly, fairly decent.
Well, now you've got me half interested in seeing it.
So, back to Roadkill.
Yes. We didn't have many in the way of major revelations in this episode, other than we realized that Sam and Dean really don't know anything about the afterlife.
That's true. I mean, it is one of those things, unless you're in, well, other shows have gone there, but in this show, it seems really realistic. And how could they know? I mean, nobody's been brought back from the dead. Well, right. I mean, Dean kind of, but he doesn't remember any of it. And, you know, they haven't jumped that hurdle to see what's out there yet. So
exactly.
We just don't know.
And, you know, it might stay that way. Maybe John will never make another appearance and we'll never figure it out.
Maybe. I really hope that they don't go the way of Charmed and go into the underworld and come back. And
right.
I liked it on that show somewhat, but it would just not be right here.
Better to have that whole death is a real possibility issue.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a standalone that it was a fun ride, but there really wasn't much going on in it. I do like the nostalgia from first season, like Hookman and Scarecrow, like you said.
Road stories always creep me out. I don't know, that's a special fear of mine, being, you know, lost on the road.
You know, you're in a vulnerable place. You don't know where you are. You don't know this, you know, anyone around. You may be 50 miles from the nearest gas station. I've been on roads
exactly.
like that. Some of the rural areas, anything could happen out there. So, okay, moving on to legends and references. There were only a couple in this episode. The first one is I-4 Dead Zone. An overpass on I-4 just north of Orlando at the St. Johns River in Seminole County. It is known as the Dead Zone because of four graves beneath the highway. The history of this area goes back to 1887 when a yellow fever epidemic hit a small Roman Catholic colony, killing four members of one of its families. With their priest dead, there was no one to administer last rites, and they were buried without ceremony in four graves. In 1905, Albert Hawkins bought the land and cleared it for farming. He found the four graves, and in respect for the dead, Hawkins farmed around the little cemetery, which sat in the middle of the field like an island. The area became known as the Field of the Dead, and was for many years a well-kept secret by the local community. When Hawkins died in 1939, his widow continued to own the land until 1960, when it was purchased by the state for the building of Interstate 4. The little cemetery was identified to the state surveyors, but the graves were not removed, and were soon covered up by fill dirt to elevate the new highway. At the exact time that the fill dirt was dumped onto the site, Hurricane Donna crossed the state. The eye of this strange storm passed right over the graves. The fury and flooding caused by Hurricane Donna disrupted highway construction for several months. Not only was Donna the worst storm to hit the interior of Central Florida in a century, it followed a very strange path. It had already crossed South Florida from the Atlantic and appeared to be heading westward into the Gulf of Mexico. Then it took a strange and eerie turn and basically followed the right-of-way Interstate 4 through Central Florida, with the eye passing over the graves about midnight. The storm exited into the Atlantic Ocean near Ormond Beach. Many people believe that this strange maneuver of Hurricane Donna was caused by the highway construction tampering with the dead. Witnesses have said that their cell phones will pick up strange voices at the south end of the Interstate 4 bridge in Seminole County. One woman reports that if she is talking with someone on the phone, the conversation is interrupted by what she believes to be the voices of the dead. This section is also infamous for an extremely high number of accidents, reports of ghost hitchhikers, static on car radios and cell phones. Also reported are sightings of white mist and balls of light as you pass through this section on the interstate. It's pretty interesting. The other one, and the only thing I could find at all relating to this story, the woman who died on the highway and so forth, is the Fisk Union, Louisiana Ghost Bridge. And there's very little out there on this. This bridge is haunted by the woman who was killed there in a car wreck years ago. She continues to look for her boyfriend there, who was in her car with her. Sounds of screams and reflections of headlights can be seen in the water and in the trees surrounding the bridge. But I haven't read anything on local accounts or anything else except this. So if anyone knows about Fisk Union, Louisiana Ghost Bridge, please let me know. And there was one song in this episode, and a good one, The House of the Rising Sun by The Animals. That's it for our discussion on Roadkill. Let's move on to Heart. Heart originally aired in the U.S. on March 22, 2007. Let's jump into the recap. It's from Wikipedia. This episode was directed by Kim Manners and written by Sarah Gamble. Winning combination there. Sam's heart is ensnared when he meets a beautiful woman named Madison with whom he shares something in common. As a great lustrous moon hangs over the city of San Francisco, Dean and Sam are on the trail of a suspected werewolf that's been killing female prostitutes during the lunar cycle. When the MO changes and a white-collar male is mauled to death in his office, the brothers interview his colleague, Madison, who tells them that she suspects her jealous ex-boyfriend may be involved. A search of the ex's apartment turns up claw marks in the mutilated body of a police officer nearby. Dean tracks down the ex while Sam stays behind to watch over Madison. The younger Winchester feels a connection to the personable, intelligent woman, and the two quickly form a friendship. That night, Dean is attacked by a female werewolf, which he found savaging Madison's ex. He manages to cut the beast with a silver blade. The next morning, Sam finds the same wound on Madison, who has no recollection of her transformation. Recognizing his own dilemma in her inability to control the evil inside her and moved her by pleas of innocence, Sam is determined to save her. He convinces Dean that they have to free her from the curse by killing the werewolf that bit and turned her. Sam guards Madison. Dean stalks the creature's favorite hunting ground near the bay and succeeds in killing the predecessor werewolf. Madison finally believes that she is a monster after seeing the damage done to her closet used to imprison her and the scratches she inflicted on Sam in her altered state. When another night passes peacefully without sign of lycanthropy in Madison, everyone is relieved that the brothers' plan had worked. In the emotional aftermath, Sam and Madison fall into each other's arms and savor a romantic interlude of carnal bliss. Their happiness is short-lived as Madison changes again. This time, the Winchesters realize there is no cure for her affliction. Bereft of hope, Madison begs Sam to end her life before she can harm more men. A tormented Sam allows his head to overrule his heart and refuses Dean's offer to perform the execution. As his younger brother puts a silver bullet into the woman he desperately wants to protect, Dean sheds one tear over Sam's immense suffering. He possibly fears that their failure to save Madison may mean that he will also fail to save Sam in the end. Let's move on to analysis with Josh. So let's talk about Heart. I really liked this episode.
I have to agree. I enjoyed the urgency of it.
I think part of it, I just moved from San Francisco. So it was right. Kind of a, it was like it took place in a city I know and with with a creature that I've always been interested in. So to me, at least the premise was really neat. And I love that Sammy fell in love again. It was really nice to see him happy and to be falling for somebody again and in a very different manner than Dean.
Right.
But in Sam's way, it seemed really realistic, even though they had just met. They had this automatic, chemistry, and it was really interesting to see.
That's true. And that's same thing. I love that, it was a creature, and I love that they tackled werewolves, another very popular legend. Mm-hmm. And I love that even Dean was excited about tackling it.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it was really cool to watch Sam, try and woo a woman again. And I think that, like you said, there was chemistry there, and if there hadn't been, it would have been really hard to buy the whole situation with how fast it moved and everything.
Yeah, I really liked Madison as an actor, like whoever that girl is. I liked how she played that character.
I think that she played it well as, the kind of woman that Sam would be attracted to.
Exactly. And that you only had a little bit of time to meet her and get to know her. And
right.
She really was able to pull that through.
It's good that the writers were able to write her in such a way that she didn't seem like, just another bimbo of the week.
Although I'd love to see Sarah again. I did like Madison.
Yeah. We haven't heard about her this whole season.
I know, not even a mention. And I was really great. It was great to see werewolves. It was really exciting.
Yes.
I was excited to see vampires when we saw it last season with Dead Man's Blood. But this season, I was waiting for it. I'd kind of heard rumors that there might be werewolves sometime this season. It made sense. I mean, it was only a matter of time before they did it, but
right.
It was really well done. I thought it would turn out really cheesy, more like the line of, Teen Wolf from back in the 80s.
Right.
But they did a really good job.
I agree. I like that they went with the more minimalist effects, when it came to dressing her up as opposed to like Buffy where they had him in a big gorilla suit and it just looked ridiculous.
Yeah, and they didn't do any of those like slow motion turn her into a werewolf sort of things.
Right.
You can just tell that there was another layer of makeup applied and then they shot it again.
Exactly.
But, yeah, I think they did did a really good job. And you didn't see everything. They left a lot of element of surprise there.
Right.
Where they would do adequate time gaps. Like, you knew it was the next morning, and they would show you the result, but they didn't show you everything that had happened, so it kind of left stuff up to your imagination.
Right. Which, you know, I'm sure it helps with the budget, but it can also be just as effective when it comes to creating tension.
Yeah, but there was a lot of excitement in this episode.
Yes, it was very exciting and very emotional.
Yes. I thought Jensen and Jared did amazing acting in this one.
Although I have, you know, an issue with how rushed the ending felt, I do believe that it was still very powerfully acted.
Yes. I mean, even though they had just met and had this amazing night and whatever, it was the course of just a couple days.
Right.
But it didn't seem like it was overly rushed. Like, you always know they have 40 minutes to do an episode, it's going to be rushed. But
right, and exactly.
And the tie-up was, yeah, not quite as well done as I probably would have liked, but it was still the way it should have ended.
Yeah, I think that it was well done in the way that, you know, it was sad and they weren't able to cure her. Like, there was kind of, you know, the fake out. You think it's going to be this big happy ending, and then it turns out that it's not, and they have to do this sacrifice that they never, you know, when they went into the job, they never expected to have, they were going to come to this.
Exactly.
So it was good that it was so powerful. It just felt like, to me, like, oh, we can't cure you, so we have to kill you right now.
Yeah. You know? No waiting.
Right. You don't get to say goodbye to your family or anything. You know, you're just dead.
Yeah. Yeah. That was kind of annoying. But I like that it wasn't a nice, big, happy ending with a bright red bow on the top. I mean, it really showed that there's sadness and horror that's in their jobs.
Right.
And it is a sacrifice. I mean, it keeps coming back to that. But it's rough. I mean, it's not like they're having a good time. I mean, they may like their job, but it's also has its definite dark points.
Right. Which is, yeah, it's been a big theme this season about how much they've had to give up in their life to, you know, do this job and to save these other people's lives.
It is sacrifice, but at the same time, they are saving people. Like, it keeps them going. So it's their ammunition.
They have to kill the girlfriend so she doesn't kill anybody else.
Yeah. Sam just does not have a good track record. He just keeps losing all the girls that he loves.
Yep, so much drama for Sam.
Yeah, you know, Dean doesn't seem to lose the girls, but that's not his thing. Maybe he has the right mentality about all of this. They brought up the whole evil Sam thing again, which was a big low point to this episode, I think.
Once again, Sam is over-identifying with the evil, and you have to wonder, you know, how many times is he going to bring it up before Dean's like, fine, I'll kill you already.
Or maybe, you know, he will go to the dark side.
Right.
You know, Luke, I am your father, all that fun stuff.
It's kind of like that serves as their connection to the overall arc. Where we'll mention, you know, Sam's still struggling with his destiny, and we'll throw that in there just to make sure nobody forgets where we're headed this season.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not like we're going to forget, but we've had so many of these standalones and even not so much a standalone, but there's just not a lot of content there for the arc. It's been a lot of episodes since we've had any reference to the ceiling demon. We haven't even heard him referenced since, like, the third one.
Right. Even Meg coming back, she didn't have anything to do with it.
Exactly. It's just been kind of, you know, I know they're trying to expand out that story arc, I think. You know, more hunters or some connection to the rest of everybody and the rest of the world, but The other thing that bothered me was we've never seen John's notebook anymore.
Oh, right.
It's as if it just isn't helping or there's just nothing new in there, but they haven't been hunting all that long and they don't know everything.
Right. And John has maybe they think they do.
Yeah, but John's been hunting for like 25 years. There's going to be a lot of information in there that can help them.
Yeah, you'd think so, but maybe the fact that it was so useless in this episode is like nailing its coffin. Oh, we're not going to use that thing anymore.
You know, it's symbolic in a way. You know, now that, well, John is dead, but not there to help them, even with the journal. It's like they're really completely on their own now. So maybe it's more of a symbolic break than a, oh, I guess he just didn't get to that yet.
They are, you know, because last season they were all, you know, working towards finding him, and then they found him and they lost him. And like you said, now they're completely on their own, even in regards to his notes.
Yeah, it's not like they can search for him or have calls from him once in a while or anything. It's, you know, he's gone. But they have Bobby. Bobby's kind of their surrogate dad, their uncle. So it's been good to see him a lot this season.
It's good that they're taking advantage of their few resources.
Seems to be the one resource that they can count on. As far as Revelations, you know, there really wasn't much at all with the story arc. It was interesting how they have all these myths and legends around werewolves, that there are all these different ways to kill them. Well, in the supernatural world, of course, there's only one, and no cures. And in the real world, apparently there's a lot of talk about different cures, if indeed would exist. I don't know that either. But hypothetically right. speaking, if there is a werewolf, there are lots of myths and legends as to how you can cure them. For this episode, it worked well, I guess, if you're trying to go to that, you know, I'm evil and I have no hope of salvation, and look, neither did she, we have to kill her. I mean, it really does right. tie into that whole evil Sam thing, but there is a way to cure if you believe in werewolf lore. That was kind of disappointing. In the canon of Supernatural, you can't right. cure a werewolf.
It'd be really sad if down the line he learned to want to be like, oh man, didn't have to kill her after all.
Yeah, that's why I think that they kind of tied all that up now. Sam doesn't have to feel guilt down the road. The best part, I think, of the whole episode was Jensen's one tear.
He's got
the Bruce Willis tear thing going on.
That's right.
He always seems to have just one tear. It's a very manly way to cry.
That's what I was just going to say.
Jared was just bawling like a baby.
He has a sensitive side, but...
Yeah. That episode even made me tear up a little bit, and that never happens.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people I talked to got teared up over that episode. I think they did a really good job of drawing you in.
Exactly. It's very effective. And quite a change from the last episode. It's like night and day. It was, that one had no emotion. This one was overfilling with emotion. So it just shows you the depths of what the show and the actors can do, which is great. So let's move on to legends and references. The first and foremost one is werewolves. Now, they mention werewolves in first season episodes Skin and Shadow, and we know that Dean was really psyched to face a werewolf, and so was I, honestly. I think it's really cool. So let's talk about some mythology about werewolves. In mythology, werewolves were entities that are human but shapeshift into wolf form during a full moon, or when they're placed under a curse. This phenomenon is also referred to as lycanthropy, for the Greek word lykoi, wolf, and anthropos, man. The change from man to wolf is held to be possible by witchcraft or magic, and can be voluntary or forced by certain cycles of the moon and certain sounds such as howling. Historical legends describe a wide variety of methods for becoming a werewolf, one of the simplest being the removal of clothing and putting on a belt made of wolf skin, probably as a substitute for the assumption of the entire animal skin, which also is frequently described. In other cases, the body is rubbed with magic salve. To drink water out of the footprint of the animal in question, or to drink from certain enchanted streams, are also considered effectual modes of accomplishing metamorphosis. Becoming a werewolf simply by being bitten by another werewolf as a form of contagion is common in modern fiction, but rare in legend, in which werewolf attacks seldom left the victim alive long enough to transform. In other cases, the transformation was supposedly accomplished by satanic allegiance for the most loathsome ends, often due to a craving for human flesh. An interesting distinction is often made between voluntary and involuntary werewolves. The former are generally thought to have been made a pact with the devil and morph into werewolves at night or indulge in mischievous acts. Involuntary werewolves, on the other hand, are werewolves by an accident of birth or health. In some cultures, individuals born during a new moon or suffering from epilepsy were considered likely to be werewolves. So, destruction. In some folklore, werewolves are immune from aging and most physical diseases. Various methods have existed for removing the werewolf form. The simplest method was the act of the enchanter, operating either on oneself or on a victim, and another was the removal of the animal belt or skin, to kneel in one spot for 100 years, to be reproached with being a werewolf, or be saluted with the sign of the cross, or addressed thrice by baptismal name, to be struck 3 blows on the forehead with a knife, or at least have 3 drops of blood drawn, have also been mentioned as possible cures. Many European folktales include throwing an iron object over or at the werewolf to make it reveal its human form. Werewolves have several described weaknesses, the most common being an aversion to wolfsbane. Like vampires, werewolves maintain an aversion to religious artifacts such as crucifixes and holy water. One of the lesser-known weaknesses is silver. as it is sometimes believed that a werewolf in human form will not transform when wearing a silver amulet. The repressive effect would be increased if the amulet were filled with wolfsbane. Stabbing with a silver dagger was believed to revert a werewolf to human form. Popular culture holds that the only way to kill a werewolf is with a silver bullet. They can be killed by any wound that destroys the heart or the brain, or by any method of death that causes brain or heart damage, such as hanging or other oxygen-deprived methods. So where do the legends come from? Many authors have speculated that werewolf and vampire legends may have been used to explain serial killings in less enlightened ages. This theory is given credence by the tendency of some modern serial killers to indulge in practices such as cannibalism, mutilation, and cyclic attacks, commonly associated with werewolves. The idea, although not the terminology, is well explored in Sabine Baring Gould's seminal work, The Book of Werewolves. A recent theory has been proposed to explain werewolf episodes in Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries. Ergot, which causes a form of foodborne illness, is a fungus that grows in place of rye grains in wet growing seasons after very cold winters. Ergot poisoning usually affects whole towns or poor sections of towns, resulting in hallucinations, mass hysteria, and paranoia, as well as convulsions and death. The hallucinogen LSD can be derived from ergot. Ergot poisoning has been propounded as both a cause of an individual believing that one is a werewolf and of a whole town believing that they have witnessed a werewolf. This theory, however, is controversial and not widely accepted. Some modern researchers have tried to use conditions such as rabies, hypertrichosis, which is excessive hair growth over the entire body, or porphyria, an enzyme disorder with symptoms including hallucinations and paranoia, to explain werewolf beliefs. Congenital erythropoietic porphyria has clinical features which include hairy hands and face, poorly healing skin, pink urine, reddish color to the teeth, and photosensitivity, which leads sufferers to go out only at night. There was an episode on CSI a couple seasons ago about this. There is also a rare mental disorder called clinical lycanthropy, which an affected person has a delusional belief that he or she is, or has transformed into another animal, but not necessarily a wolf or werewolf. Supernatural lycanthropy myths could originate from people relating their experience of what could be classified as a state of psychosis. Others believe that werewolf legends were partially inspired by shamanism and totem animals in primitive and nature-based cultures. The term therianthropy has been adopted to describe a spiritual concept in which the individual believes he or she is the spirit or soul, in whole or in part, of a non-human animal. Some researchers believe that werewolves are misidentified primates or a new species of animal. So there are a lot of theories out there, and of course none of them can be identified as truth or fact, but I think it's really fascinating and made for a great episode. So there were several songs in this episode. Down on the Street by the Stooges, Look at You by the Screaming Trees, one of my favorites, Silent Lucidity by Queensryche, and Smoking Gun by Kip Winger. That concludes our episode review of Heart. Let's move on to our final review of the night, Hollywood Babylon. From now on, my voice may sound a little bit different. I'm trying out a new microphone, and I really like it, so I didn't want to wait till the next episode airs to try it out. So bear with me, this is a trial period. Hollywood Babylon originally aired in the U.S. on April 19, 2007. It was directed by Philip Segrecia and written by Ben Edlund. The name of the episode is from a book of the same title written by Kenneth Anger detailing the scandals of celebrities from the 1900s to the 1950s. On the set of Hellraiser 2, The Reckoning, being directed by Mick G, a stagehand is killed and the star of the movie, Tara Benchley, reports seeing an apparition near the body. Dean has convinced Sam to come to Los Angeles for a break after the death of Madison, but Sam wants to throw himself into work. Dean, a movie buff, becomes enthusiastic as he discovers the movie is a horror movie starring one of his favorite actresses, Tara. It doesn't take the boys long on the set to discover that the stagehand's death was faked by the studio executives to promote interest in the movie. But then studio executive Brad Redding dies in the middle of the set after encountering a ghost. Dean goes undercover, joining the crew as a PA, a production assistant, a job he embraces. The boys discover that a young actress killed herself in the 1920s after being wooed and then dumped and fired by a studio executive. They find her buried in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, where they burn and salt her bones. After another producer is killed, Sam notices that the Latin in the movie script is a real summoning ritual. They confront the writer, Martin Flagg, who admits that any authentic rituals in the script are all that remain from the original script by writer Walter Dixon. Dixon lures Flagg onto the set to kill him, but Sam and Dean arrive in time to save him. Walter admits that he was conjuring real ghosts and forcing them to kill those he saw as responsible for ruining his script. Before they can stop him, Walter destroys the talisman he was using, thus freeing the spirits who, enraged at being
being used, turn on Walter and kill him. The production of the movie continues with Martin incorporating his experiences with the ghosts into the script. Sam finds Dean emerging disheveled and with a post-coital glow from Tara's trailer. Sam and Dean walk off into the sunset together until it's wheeled away and revealed it's just another Hollywood prop. Let's move on to analysis and discussion with Josh.
So let's move on to Hollywood Babylon, an episode I really liked.
It was really, really enjoyable, especially to those of us who are dedicated fans.
Yes, it was as if this episode was written for the fans. We had uber happy fanboy Dean.
Right.
So he's just kind of completely different. He was this, you know, angry, melancholy guy, and now he's this over-the-top, excitable, this is so cool, I'm in LA kind of guy. It
plays right into his, you know, personality when it comes to all his pop culture references that he makes.
Exactly. And the use of humor. I know a lot of people didn't like it, but I thought it was great.
Yeah.
You know, it was written to be funny, but, it, you know, really over the top and corny.
I think that it was good. I mean, it was very enjoyable and a very much, you know, tongue-in-cheek look at Hollywood and the things that probably they have to deal with, you know, in the movies and on this show as well.
Exactly. And there were so many little inside jokes almost that you,
right,
if you weren't either a really intense fan of the show, that you would know the actors and their histories and, you know, the producers and all this stuff, you wouldn't get a lot of these references. But
right,
to the basic, just tuning in kind of casual watcher, it wouldn't take away from it. But to the fans, like the fandom, like the Gilmore Girls reference, you know, when they get off the tour bus. And I mean, Dean's reference of star maps. I drive by those signs every day on the way to work. The clothes rack that goes by just as they get off the tram and they're walking down the road. That's actually Jared Padalecki's clothes rack from his set.
Oh,
and he
that's
does
great.
A double take and he looks at it. And it was just absolutely hilarious because of like, oh, that's actually his clothes. If you look at the behind the scenes from season one DVDs.
That's great. And then they talk about how the weather is very Canadian.
Yeah. And they have the comments about producer Mick G and his, you know, he's a bad director. And then
right.
Boogeyman, and that is actually Eric Kripke's movie.
Yes, and they specifically talk about how bad the script is.
And they had all those great stars, guest stars from all those other TV shows. And
I really enjoyed seeing Gary Cole because I think he's great at playing one of those, you know, suits who really have no idea what's going on. And I love the bit about the super hearing and how they included that in the movie after he mentioned it. It just makes you wonder if, you know, the show has to deal with stuff like that where they're like, hey, maybe you should explain it better and dumb it down for everybody.
Yeah, and all those comments about, well, how do you really kill a ghost? And
right.
You can't use a shotgun. Salt? That's funny, you know?
That's right. Are we still looking at condiments?
And the fake trailer.
Oh, yeah, that was funny.
They used clips from earlier episodes of Supernatural to make that trailer. Yeah, you see the truck from Route 666, and you see the dripping blood off the knife. The fake trailer
was great.
I enjoyed the trailer.
Yep. It was, and I liked the name of the movie where it was The Reckoning, because that just sounds so cheesy horror movie. I was just going to say, overall, I thought it was very cleverly done, you know. It was a lot of inside jokes, a lot of old references, like when he does the whole speech about how the producer would have wanted us to go on, and supposedly Mick G making that speech about how they all need to pull together, but they just can't do it right now. And
I liked the bits about the, you know, the dead person on the set and the myths, and they incorporated a little bit of that in there. Not that there was a lot of storyline on this one, but they did throw in there the what they call the poltergeist effect.
Right.
The movie Poltergeist from 1980, 82, something like that. 12 people associated with the show, actors, producers, crew, you name it, have died.
Wow.
It's a really high proportion for a movie that's only 25 years old. And they all died either really mysteriously or very suddenly. It wasn't like they, you know, were very old and died. Like, it was not like that at all. And they said it was because when they were filming, if you've seen it, there were a lot of corpses that
right.
came up because they had buried on a, or were built on this burial ground. The rumor was that some of the corpses that were used in the film were real human remains. And that there was some sort of curse on the lot that they were filming, and that's why people died. So that was part, I think, that was part of where this whole premise came from in this episode.
Right, which is a good way of playing on a more modern myth, you know. And I thought it was neat, and I'd never heard of this before, of a movie doing this, but it's entirely possible, where they hired the actor to fake his own death to create buzz for a movie.
Yeah, I've never heard of that either, but honestly, I wouldn't be surprised.
Right, exactly. The only problem I had, I felt like having such a clever episode, the ending to me seemed a little awkward and forced. From the hack writer, you know, just walking around on the set alone, to the original writer throwing a big fit and smashing his little talisman, it just seemed a little weak to me.
Yeah, like because they didn't have a storyline, they were trying to build something.
Right.
And we didn't really have anyone, a new bad guy. Like, there was nothing really, oh, look, it's a werewolf. I mean, there was nothing really new at all.
Right.
About anything about this episode as far as the myths or legends, well, except for the poltergeist thing. But, I mean, you didn't have this new bad guy, like a Wendigo or something, you know.
Whatever. Right.
It really wasn't. It was just some, you know, random thing. And I think that was the downfall, because they didn't have any sort of underlying legend.
Right. I think you're right. And that made the ending that seemed a little weird. And,
yeah.
You know, and they just trying to wrap everything up.
Yeah. And I think they realized that and thought, oh, we need to throw in a little bit more humor. And that's when they threw in the lovely Verizon product placement.
Right.
Which,
yes,
was horrible.
Yes, it was. It was pretty blatant.
Yes, your cell phone can save you from ghosts, so don't forget that.
Right. Buy one now.
Yes, for VCast or whatever it's called, there is all that Supernatural content you can download from Verizon. And I've been a Verizon customer forever, but still, that was way, way obnoxious.
Which makes you wonder if it was intentional.
Well, it had to have been. I mean, the whole rest of the episode was tongue-in-cheek, like you said, so it had to have been intentional, but I think they're just trying to cover up that there really wasn't any plot.
Exactly. Which, you know, and I think that's another downside. For us fans, it's really easy for us to enjoy, but if you were a newcomer, it would have been really hard to get into this show at all if you'd never seen it before.
Yeah, and the same would go if you don't get pop culture references. Let's say you live in a country where the translation is going to be a little strange, or if you just haven't seen a lot of these things, all of the episodes have a lot of pop culture. So if you aren't into classic rock or old TV shows and films and stuff, you may not get all of them. It may seem a little strange, but this one was really heavy on the pop culture.
It's great for us who really enjoy it and everything, but anyone else might, you know, be a little let down. Well, the episode itself, you know, makes me feel, I really enjoyed it, and I had a good time watching it. It makes me feel a little weird when I think about it, because it usually takes a show a little longer in its run to start with a self-parody, you know? Mm. And I think if you start in making fun of yourself when you're still asking people to take the show seriously, that it can be a slippery slope, and you just have to be real careful.
There just hasn't been a lot of story arc progression over the last few episodes.
Yeah, we didn't get really any major revelations this episode. Other than the fact that you can see spirits on video, at least spirits that haunt movie sets.
Yes, that might come in handy.
Right.
It's like an EMF detector only with a video screen. At least we didn't get the Evil Sam speech.
That's true. We've got a lot of Dean eating, but no Sam whining, so that's good.
But the thing that bothered me about this episode and in Heart is that they took place in big cities. San Francisco, LA. Aren't they trying to hide from the feds?
Yeah. You'd think they'd stay away from that type.
Yeah, they hit up, you know, some of the most populous cities in the country, and they're always swarming with police and FBI, and if they're wanted by the FBI, they're going to be on some wanted list, and the police departments are going to have that, especially in the metropolitan areas. If I were them, I'd go back to Kansas or Nebraska and hide out and work small towns again.
Stay away from the limelight, but they like to live dangerously. Overall, we just had, you know, Sam falling for another woman, and that, you know, going to have an impact on his emotional well-being, probably. And he's still struggling with his destiny, as usual.
I mean, I didn't like having Joe around, but we haven't even heard from her, or Ellen, or Bobby, or anyone for the last few. Probably not a wise thing to do with the war coming, and they're going to need protection if they do get caught by the cops and stuff. They may need some help, and
probably just saving it all for the two-part season finale. The only real explanation. Yep. Yeah, because not a lot on the ceiling demon, or like you said, the war, or In Touch with Anybody, Ava, just pretty much standalone episodes.
Yep. As much as I like that, I do miss having the main arc episodes.
I do too. I miss them. I miss them all being tied together.
Yes, or at least if they had a couple major storylines going. Not
Right.
this Sam is evil. That's not a storyline. That's just a low point. So.
Right. It's true. They did a lot of that with season one too. You know, there was the big hunt for John
Yep.
and the ceiling demon and hunt for all that. And it was touched on in most of the episodes, even though each episode had its own story.
Yeah, even if they made the comment that, oh, John's not calling me back, or they would just have where someone would make a phone call to him, they'd find something about him, or whatever, there'd be like little bits to go on.
Right. Or they meet Meg and that kind of thing. And
But this season, we went like 6 or 8 episodes without anything.
other than Sam's whining. Yep. But I guess, you know, it switched back to where Sam's the angsty one because fans were really upset at the beginning of the season when Dean was the one that was carrying all the emotional burden and that just didn't seem like him. And so he finally relieved himself of that burden. Now it seems like Sam's got to be the one to carry it.
So let's move on to legends and references. One, the location is on the Warner Brothers Studios in Burbank, Los Angeles County. The cemetery is Hollywood Forever on Santa Monica Boulevard. Number two, the Poltergeist Curse is an urban legend that supposed curse is or was attached to the Poltergeist motion picture series and its stars. Josh and I talked about this in the analysis, but the idea that the casts of the several movies in the series were in some way cursed is a superstition based on these facts. Five of the cast members of these movies have died. Two of these five died at a young age, 12 and 22. It's not clear that these particular films are really atypical in the number or nature of the deaths of the actors, but it is kind of strange. So we have some trivia. McGee is the producer of Supernatural, Pussycat Dolls: A Search for the Next Doll, The O.C., and Charlie's Angels, and Charlie's Angels: Full Throttle. The real McGee can be seen standing behind Sam and Dean in the scene where the crew is listening to faux McGee. The set of Hellraisers 2 may look familiar. The water tower is from Crossroad Blues. The cabin is from Roadkill. The deer's head on the wall has appeared in the boys' motel room in Nightmare, John's room in Salvation, and Steve Wendell's home in Born Under a Bad Sign. In the faux trailer for Hellraiser 2, writer Martin Flagg is also credited as the writer of Cornfield Massacre and Monster Truck, which are illustrated from images with Supernatural episodes, Scarecrow, and Route 666. There's also a shot of the hook from Hookman, Claire's desiccated hands from The Usual Suspects, Gordon and his bloody knife from Bloodlust, and the inside of Angela's coffin from Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. In Martin's office, there's a poster for Carnivore Carnival, which has an image from Everybody Loves a Clown. The line, "Swimming pools and movie stars," is from the theme song of the TV show Beverly Hillbillies. And the line, "Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs," is a line from John McClane, Bruce Willis, and Die Hard. Movies and TV shows referenced in this episode were, there were so many. Josh and I mentioned a few in our discussion. There was Ghost Rider, Creepshow, Gilmore Girls, the movie tour passes through the Stars Hollow set, and of course, Jared Padalecki starred as Dean Forrester in 65 episodes. Lewis and Clark, which is the forerunner to Smallville. Also, previous credit of Supernatural producer and director Robert Singer. Poltergeist, Fear.com, Ghost Ship, Boogeyman, written by Eric Kripke. Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin, Critters 3, Three Men and a Baby, and Lord of the Dead. It's a real movie. The tagline is, "Who knew the Lord of the Dead had a son who wanted no part of the family business?" Sounds familiar. And there was one song in this episode. It was called Green Peppers by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
The song of the night is Redemption by Kevin Reeves and Ian Baird. Enjoy. No matter what it takes,
dead man. Never gave a damn. The anger boils, the gun recoils, spilling blood upon the land. When I saw the road ahead, man, I didn't like the view, so I turned around. But all I found were deceptions born anew. But I'll church on.
So I have an article for you this week. It's called Five Reasons Not to Miss Supernatural Finale by Bill Goodykuntz of the Arizona Republic, May 6, 2007. In the land of Lost and The Sopranos, it's easy to overlook a really good small show like Supernatural. Here are five reasons not to. Number one, it's scary. Of course it is. You may be thinking it's called Supernatural, but you'd be surprised how many scary TV shows aren't. On this show, always wet and dark, the thrills and chills are a priority. And it shows. Number two, it's funny. Supernatural has a great sense of humor, which is key. A show like this can't take itself too seriously. Granted, there's not much funny about a ghost that kills people, like, out loud, but that's the point. Supernatural breaks up the terror with laughs, well and often. Number three, the acting. Ha, just kidding. Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles as the two demon-hunting brothers aren't exactly on the short list for Emmys, but for this, two handsome fellows running around helping people, often attractive young women, surprise, surprise, this is the CW after all, they work just fine. Number four, the music. Dean Ackles is a classic rock fiend, so he's always blasting some old 70s warhorse or other from the speakers of his beloved Black Impala. It also allows producers to give episodes titles of, say, an old Led Zeppelin song, What Is and Should Never Be. Love that. Number five, the end. Of this season, anyway. The two-part finale kicks off Thursday and should reveal more about whether Sam's Padalecki's powers are. Note the optimism. Season finale. The CW hasn't announced whether Supernatural will be back next fall. Here's hoping. Well, that's it for this episode. Supernatural returns this week with the season finale, All Hell Breaks Loose Part 2. I have to tell you, if you didn't see Part 1, go find a friend, TiVo, however you can get it, watch Part 1. It's by far the most phenomenal episode I think we've ever seen on the show, even considering the end of last season. And I cannot wait for what happens on Thursday. We'll be back next week with a discussion of Folsom Prison Blues and what is and what should never be. Thanks for listening and take care.
Thank you for listening to the Supernatural Podcast. You can visit my website at supernaturalpodcast.blogspot.com or send me an email at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. Please note that the opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and not of the producers of Supernatural or the CW. Audio clips played on this podcast are property of the CW and no infringement is intended. Some of the music heard here is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.